This is the Winchester Talking Newspaper for the week ending the 4th of September 2015. Hello and welcome to the Winchester Talking Newspaper with extracts from the Hampshire Chronicle dated the 3rd of September 2015, which this week has been edited by Jean Carswell, Ken Clemenson and Barbara Chase. Our readers today are Margot Meredith.
Hello.
John Richards.
Hello.
And I'm your presenter, John Parker. The main headlines this week are Curtain Call for Opera? Hotel emptied in gas alert. And heavy rain hitting farmers' harvest. So we start with the story behind the first headline.
Curtain Call for Opera. Grange Park Opera, one of Hampshire's premier cultural festivals, is poised to leave Alresford. The opera company is considering abandoning Northington Grange, its home for 17 years, and moving to Surrey. The threat of GPO, and please do understand it's the initials for Grange Park Opera and not the General Post Office, the threat of GPO vacating the Grange will be greeted with dismay by local businesses who benefit from the trade its summer festival brings. GPO has been based at the listed mansion since 1998 and has developed an opera season to rival that of the internationally renowned Glyndebourne. This summer saw Bryn Terfel perform in Fiddler on the Roof. The opera is negotiating a new lease as the current one expires in 2016, but it is unhappy about the rolling 10-year lease on offer and is tempted by a 40-year lease at the home of Bamber Gascoigne, the 80-year-old former presenter of the TV quiz University Challenge. The opera is also attracted by the prospect of a longer season than 8 weeks at the Grange. But the landowner of the Grange, the Baring family, is keen to keep the opera at the unique venue set in Parkland by Northington Lake. Mark Baring, the son of Lord Ashburton, told the Chronicle it was untrue that GPO had been asked to pay £1 million to stay. Mr. Baring declined to discuss details of the negotiations, but said, "We are very committed to continuing the opera festival. We think it has been a great thing." Wasfi Carney, who was the GPO founder, made a great contribution to set it up. If she wants to go to Surrey, putting something in place with Bamber Gascoigne, that is up to her. But we think this is a great festival that should continue. Mr. Baring said he had never been asked to extend the season, but it is something he would consider. Should GPO leave, then the Barings would look to attract another opera company. It has been a great success story, and it would be a great pity if it went, but we are determined to ensure opera continues there, come what may, he said. The 550-seat auditorium was built with publicly raised funds, including from many local people. Simon Evans, managing director of The Naked Grape and chairman of the Alresford Chamber of Commerce, said, "It would be a great shame to lose this summer event, as it is a unique cultural event. I'm sure many local businesses would be interested in talking to the organisers to see if increased business involvement could help to support them." In a statement, GPO said, "The 2016 festival will take place at the Grange, but we are now in a position when our lease is coming to an end. The GPO charity trustees are obviously considering the long-term future. To this end, we are exploring the possibility of a new lease at the Grange, as well as looking at other sites in and around the home counties. We do understand that our members and sponsors feel great affection for Grange Park Opera, and we will keep you informed of developments."
Hotel emptied in gas alert. A Winchester hotel was evacuated following a suspected chlorine leak. Guests at Winchester Hotel and Spa in Worthy Lane were woken after an alarm went off in the spa area at 6:45 a.m. last Saturday. A total of 7 fire engines with more than 20 firefighters were called, including from Winchester, Sutton Scotney, Redbridge and Eastleigh. Dozens of guests converged on the car park just outside the main entrance of the hotel for more than 2 hours while crews tried to discover where the gas leak came from. It turned out to be a false alarm. Dad of two, Mark Arnold, 44, from Woking, said, "Everyone was outside and all just huddled around and the hotel staff kept us up to date with everything that was happening and looked after us." Another guest was Peter Reed, 58, visiting from Ryde on the Isle of Wight. He said, "It was about 6:45 a.m. when we got woken up and we were all told to go to the outside area around the car park. I could see 5 fire engines and 2 ambulances, and there was a specialist van was there too. The people going into the hotel all had yellow suits on. It took about 2 hours and 15 minutes until we were allowed to go back in. The hotel staff were very good and provided us with cakes and food. We were all looking to see if there was any smoke, and the firefighters thought it was a chlorine leak."
Heavy rain hitting farmers' harvest. Torrential rain is hitting the profits of scores of Hampshire farmers as they struggle to bring in the harvest. Heavy downpours last Wednesday and again at the weekend again prevented combine harvesters from going onto the fields. They are facing being hit by heavy losses as their sodden crops wilt in the fields. Hampshire farmers have been reporting that their profits will be hit by 15 to 20%. Sandra Nichols, spokesman for the Hampshire branch of the National Farmers Union, said, "It all looked quite promising in late July and early August when the harvest started. Then the rain came and the combines couldn't get out in the fields to cut the cereal crops." Bob Singleton, who farms at Byton, said, "It has affected us. We have not got the harvest out yet. It's just frustrating. It was all going well and then the weather changed. If we do not get the harvest soon, it will cost a lot of money." While Chris Cook, former county NFU chairman who farms in Twyford, said the weather would have cost farmers thousands of pounds. Mr. Cook said, "I think that the difference this year could be that it does not sound like much, but farmers could lose £5 per tonne and that could cost them thousands. In this area, we are a week behind and it is not ideal." Gareth Jenkins, who farms at Mottisfont, said the delays would affect planting of next year's crops, adding, "A lot of our wheat was for milling, but it now won't be because the quality of the wheat has gone down because of all the wet weather." Last week's downpours also led to flooding in parts of Winchester. Manholes overflowed on the High Street, with Lloyds Bank forced to close on Wednesday and Thursday with a leaky roof. Hinton Apner House, near Cheriton, closed when rainwater flooded the cellar. Firefighters had to drain waist-high water from the basement, where water had damaged walls, floors, electrics and Christmas decorations. Louise Washington, visitor experience officer, said, "It was just the sheer amount of water that came down on Wednesday. We lost our roof a year and a half ago, so we've got a lot of storage down in the cellar. We've now got quite a drying out process. All the floors are boarded, and I think it's going to take quite a long time for the walls to dry." That concludes the headline stories, and we now continue with the death announcements. Clark, Mary Irene Clark, on the 15th of August in Red Oaks Nursing Home, aged 94. Cousins, Anne Frances Cousins, on the 16th of August, aged 77. Gay, Ada, known as Mary Gay, on the 26th of August, aged 94. Gould, Diana Elizabeth Gould, of Middle Whitston, Meshaw, North Devon, on the 27th of August, aged 78. Parker, Anthony Charles Parker, at home on the 27th of August. And now we have Christian comment.
This week is written by the Reverend Paul Kennedy, and he entitles it The Natural Caring Instinct in All of Us. As a parish priest, I visit people in hospital on a weekly basis, but last month the tables were turned, and after an adder bite, I became the patient. What did I learn as I experienced things from another perspective? Firstly, I felt huge admiration for all the NHS staff. It didn't matter whether someone was cleaning up after me, serving lunch, attaching a drip or giving an expert diagnosis. The care and attention were first class. People that most of us, hopefully, rarely come across in a professional capacity ensured not only that I was well cared for, but also that I felt well cared for. Secondly, I experienced some of the empathy and patience that is part of our care service. In both A&E and later in the acute medical unit, patients who were confused and relatives who were distressed were given time and attention in an extremely pressured environment. This personal care was present both in the early hours of the morning and in the middle of the day from people who seemed to have a natural vocation to be alongside others in their time of need. Many of the hospital staff were people of faith and found time to reflect with me on discovering that I was a vicar, but goodwill and caring is part of the natural human condition. While I personally felt a bit silly for getting bitten when walking in the New Forest in sandals, this was never pointed out to me. I, along with every other patient there, was a valued individual at a time of need. My overriding experience? Well, it's the natural care instinct awakened in every human on encountering someone in need. The other side of that personal experience is how do we care for those that are not physically alongside, and the abstract statistic or distant news story. How do we care for the refugees in Calais? Or do we just fear them becoming a swarm? How do we care for those crossing the Mediterranean in flimsy boats? Or are we happy to leave that problem to our poorer European neighbours in Greece and Italy? If we met these people face to face and saw the trauma in their eyes, then I'm sure we would begin to see things differently, share some of their pain, and our natural urge to care would be awakened. Christianity is a fleshly faith. We proclaim that God became flesh and experienced all the joy and pain of a human life in the wandering prophet Jesus. That experience included humiliation, torture, and death. No human being, no matter how abhorrently a regime or band of fanatics treats them, is beyond the love and experience of God. No human being should be beyond our love and care. If a daft, wandering, sandal-wearing parson is within the care of the NHS, how much more should the refugee be within the care of this country and their experience written on our hearts?
Next we come to letters to the editor. If you yourself would like to send a letter to the editor to the Hampshire Chronicle, you can do so by either telephoning 01962 860 836, that's 01962 860 836, emailing letters@hampshirechronicle.co.uk, that's letters@hampshirechronicle.co.uk, or writing to the editor at 5 Upper Brook Street, Winchester, SO23 8AL. That's 5 Upper Brook Street, Winchester, SO23 8AL. 10 letters this week. I'm sorry to say, inevitably, the first couple concern Silver Hill.
And this is the first letter about Silver Hill. It's from Kim Gottlieb, Winchester City Councillor for Itchen Valley. Sir, the summer may have had some golden moments, but there's been no relief for the Silver Hill campaign, as preparations for the next legal action, if needed, have been constant. Other efforts have included making a further submission to the eagerly awaited Silver Hill review. Included in my submission was an explanation as to why I believe that the City Council should have known, before the judicial review took place, that it was very likely to lose in court and that it could have avoided expending a great deal of time, effort and your money. Researching the history of the project again gave me an opportunity to reappraise the circumstances leading up to the judicial review. I now believe, as a result of the court finding, that the City Council may have acted unlawfully and that Councillor Rob Humby, who resigned as leader, should be exonerated. The same would apply to the members of his cabinet. What I found is a situation in which cabinet, when making the decision that was the subject of the judicial review, lacked the information, advice and guidance it should have had the benefit of. There are questions to be asked as to why this situation occurred and when it began. I believe it dates back at least to the time Henderson revealed its desire to change the scheme, coincidentally just after the CPO was confirmed in March 2013. Looking forward, the deal with Henderson is not yet done and dusted, and the council is still able to terminate the contract without suffering a penalty. However exhausted or exasperated councillors might feel after months of battling and years of waiting, they should grab with both hands the opportunity to do things right architecturally, financially and legally. Winchester deserves no less. Kim A. Gottlieb, Winchester City Councillor for Itchen Valley.
Karen Barrett writes, with the title Resist Pressure. Sir, the point made in my letter regarding Silver Hill, Chronicle of the 27th of August, becomes more relevant by the day. My main concern following Winchester City Council's decision to stick with Henderson was my doubt over this particular developer's commitment to delivering the affordable housing and new bus station which comprised the crucial elements of the 2009 scheme. I refer to the government's freeing up of planning as offering opportunities for developers to amend planning permissions already granted. This has happened now. Since the government scrapped its pledge on housing standards, i.e. zero carbon houses, in March, I have become aware of applications by developers, at least one ongoing and one already granted, to reduce the sustainability of their new builds from code level 5 to code level 4, in spite of the fact that the higher codes were conditions of their planning permissions in the first place. While I sympathise with the difficult planning position planning officers find themselves in when the government moves the goalposts, I would prefer to see such applications refused so that the legitimacy of applying new planning policy retrospectively can be properly tested through the appeal process. Simply caving in to pressure from developers reinforces my fears over Silver Hill, as who knows what new planning freedoms will have been introduced by the time Henderson gets going. And that letter was from Karen Barrett, Byron Avenue, Full Flood, Winchester.
Chris Hansford writes, inappropriate site. Sir, your editorial, College's Gas Mill is Raising Big Questions, as in Chronicle of August the 27th, is a reminder of how off-base Sparsholt College can become when mixing education with climate change. I write to suggest that the college is undertaking another inappropriate large-scale application, this time for an anaerobic digester. If the proposal is sound, let the college lease, rent or hire a suitable piece of land adjacent to the A34 or any other suitable location and run students to see this in action. I used to teach in further education colleges in the, quote, built environment, unquote, and took students to visit buildings in process of construction. It was never suggested that we ought to build construction edifices on the college's own land to further the students' experience. Chris Hansford, Clifton Road, Winchester.
Pamela Johnston writes about a forthcoming mosaic lecture. Sir, many of your readers will remember the excavation of Spa Schult Roman Villa and its renowned mosaic, now in Winchester Museum. It is exactly 50 years since this mosaic was found. To celebrate this anniversary, a lecture has been organised by the museum, which will take place on Wednesday, September the 16th at 7 p.m. in Spa Schult Village Hall. The speaker will be Dr. Stephen Kosh, who is the joint author of a four-volume work on all the mosaics in Roman Britain. The lecture will be entitled The Spa Schult Roman Villa. We know this will be a popular event, with people coming from near and far, including people who actually took part in the dig. Wine will be available, and admission will be just £2. The Spa Schult Conversations, I think they're supposed to be Conservations Group, have facilitated the arrangements, with special thanks to Dr. Neville Sutton and Dr. Edgar Feuchtwanger. More information is available on the Hampshire Culture Trust website. Pamela Johnston, Abbots Barton.
Joyce Gerard and Pauline Chard invite you to join our market. Sir, Winchester Country Market has been a successful organisation for many years, and we are very keen to continue their success. However, many of their talented members have decided to hang up their aprons in the next few months. We're keen to invite new people, especially those who have developed their own talents and are keen cake makers and cooks, to join us. You can make a little pin money for yourself and show off your skills at the same time. So many cookery shows like the Great British Bake Off with Mary Berry and Paul Hollywood have generated a keen interest in the art of cooking and making cake of all descriptions. Members have the benefits of completing a hygiene certificate, which enables them to sell their goods commercially. A very comprehensive guide provides every assistance and also means that you are covered by insurance as a certified producer. We also have crafters, plant growers, prize-winning jam makers, and many others who enjoy the art of setting up their own market together each week and sharing ideas. To become a full member is only a 5p token payment to enjoy the benefits of a professional organisation. You do not pay for your table at the weekly market. All running costs of the market are taken from a small percentage taken from each item you produce and actually sell. Hampshire Country Markets Society Limited have just celebrated their 80th birthday, so you can see that we are a fully established organisation supported by talented people from all walks of life. We look forward to welcoming you to join us. Please contact the market manager or the Hampshire market advisor to discuss, and we will be delighted to talk to you. We love to cook, craft and grow just for you. And that letter was from Joyce Gerard, who is the market advisor for Hampshire WI, and Pauline Chard, market manager of Winchester Country Market.
Voting with feet, says M. Ellis. Sir, as a long-standing business account holder of Barclays Bank, which regularly has used the branch in Alresford, I have long been concerned by the actions of the senior management of the Barclays Bank Group, as noted in the Chronicle of August the 27th. As with many others in the financial services sector, the bank relies on using customers' deposits to provide income for its business and generate dividends for its shareholders. As far as I know, the population of Alsford has grown during the last 10 years, whilst the spokesman for Barclays opines that business for the local branch has declined, and in so doing cites a number of reasons for this alleged decline. I suggest that many of its customers, like me, have become alarmed by the actions in which Barclays have become involved. In recent years, Barclays' managing directors have come and gone. The latest appointee has embarked upon a significant cost-cutting programme which has resulted in the Alsford branch becoming one of the victims of this policy, thus denying or reducing availability of personal banking services to the town. Perhaps the great and the good of Barclays senior management should countenance, for example, a reduction in the worldwide sponsorship of sporting and entertainment events designed to enrich participants and provide largesse to institutional investors in their pursuit of dividends, in part funded by depositors, as a means to reducing costs rather than cutting a facility which provides a vital service to the total community of Alsford, be it personal or business. For me, the closure of the Alsford branch is the straw of frustration which has broken the camel's back. For the reasons of broken trust, I have decided to vote with my feet and close my family business accounts with the company. M. Ellis, Alsford Road, Bishop Sutton.
Ford improvements causing chaos, writes T. Riley. Sir, can anybody tell me why Hampshire County Council resurrected the Lady Croft Ford in Alsford as viable road for vehicles? For decades, this lane leading to the Ford has been virtually unused by anything other than the odd four-wheel drive vehicle. The road is used continuously by walkers with and without dogs, and many children on bikes and with fishing nets. It is a designated SSSI, and as such I find it unfathomable that both HCC and the Environment Agency have seemingly ignored its recreational use, and having spent vast sums of money 2 years ago laying concrete ramps to facilitate vehicle entry and exit, which resulted in chaos as vehicles were towed out daily. And they have now seen fit to lay concrete blocks to make it drivable. I hope that HCC have equal vast sums of money to spend in compensation claims when the first child or dog is hit by a car on what is now becoming a rat run. T. Riley, New Farm Road, Alsford.
Nina Bailey writes about greedy priority. Sir, just as rotten apples in the banking system are now being exposed and rightly condemned, those in property development and planning also deserve our opprobrium of awards. Sanctioning the systematic sabotage of gardens and replacing virtually all the trees and anything green with extensive vehicle access to multiple solar-panelled human hutches for misguided millionaires is hardly saving the planet. Manicured landscaping also seemingly ticking their boxes. Surely it is those who thanklessly resist financial temptation and preserve the natural vegetation of their gardens who might just manage to keep Winchester's air quality at a safe level for the benefit of our ever-increasing population. It is an insult to those long-term residents that in order to create the illusion of an upmarket street scene, it is they who must endure the view of the solar panels facing their gardens and loss of privacy. Furthermore, the noise and diesel fumes from the construction vehicles continually pollute our environment. Once again, it is greed before principles that is rewarded. At least the birds, butterflies, bees, and a recently observed single hedgehog seem to know best where it is nice to live. And that letter was from Nina Bailey of Berwick Avenue, Winchester.
Christopher Mitchell says, abolish charge. Sir, I couldn't agree more with the letter sent in by R. Somers Cox about costly cathedral visits, as shown in the Chronicle of August the 27th. I think it is also obscene to charge entry, and it should be abolished. And a debate would be a good idea. I have family that come here from Surrey and London and were shocked to find that Winchester Cathedral was charging for entry. I have been to many cathedrals with my wife, and Winchester and Salisbury are the only ones that charge. I will not pay the charges in Winchester out of principle. I live here, and hopefully something can be done to sort this out. It must affect tourism as well. Christopher Mitchell, Minden Way, Stanmore, Winchester.
Fair and square, writes Seamus McLaughlin. Sir, we are lucky to live in a beautiful part of this country and should be able to share it for one weekend with the 50,000 people who attended Boomtown Fair. I hope that the enjoyment of so very many can be weighed against those few serial complainants. South Downs National Park Authority will hopefully see the merits of Boomtown Fair continuing and thriving. And that letter's from Seamus McLaughlin, Bramdean Common, Alsford.
Next we have the items of historical interest, and we have them from 100 years ago, 50 years and 25 years ago. 100 years ago, September the 4th, 1915, tigers drowned. The fears we expressed at the time of the issue of the loss of the Royal Edward, that's the name of a ship, that a draft of the Hampshire Regiment, the Tigers, was on board the ill-fated vessel, have unfortunately proved to be only too well-founded. It is now officially known that some 200 non-commissioned officers and men sent out by the 13th Battalion were on board, and we have endeavoured to obtain a full list of their names, but have been informed that no official list has yet been issued. We understand that there are some 30 survivors, and there is but little chance that of that number being increased to any great extent.
50 years ago, September the 4th, 1965, silent alarm. Hampshire County Council Fire Services Committee at Winchester on Wednesday decided not to immediately follow the growing national practice of fitting two-tone horns to fire appliances, but to go it alone for 6 months. It was stated that the Hampshire and Isle of Wight Constabulary are to fit such horns to their vehicles, but that no decision has yet been made about the county ambulance service. The meeting rejected a recommendation from the county chief fire officer that £1,077 should be spent on 100 horns and accepted instead a motion that the matter should be deferred for 6 months.
25 years ago, illegal car wash. If more dirty cars than usual are seen in King Somborne from now on, it could be because the popular monthly car wash operated so successfully by the local scout group for the past 18 months has been declared illegal. Scout leader Chris Andrews has been notified by the Southern Water Authority that the operation is not lawful, as the water supply to the scout headquarters is a normal domestic supply as opposed to one regulated or metered. The car wash is deemed to be a commercial operation which may be not be rather carried out from a domestic supply.
The Hampshire Chronicle editorial comment is titled "Sad Day If Opera Has to Leave the Mansion." It would be a sad day if Grange Park Opera should leave Northington Grange after nearly 20 years. Every summer, the empty mansion near Alsford becomes a home for world-class opera. Thousands of people enjoy the performances and bring a huge boost to local shops, pubs, restaurants and hotels. Set aside where the Grange Park Opera is playing a game of poker over the negotiations with the Baring family, it should be remembered that hundreds, if not thousands, of people contributed to the building of the 550-seat opera venue. It would be uncertain if the landlords, the Baring family, could attract another tenant. This would be a bitter taste in the mouth should Grange Park Opera leave. And next, we have Letter from Westminster, which will be followed by a first-person comment.
Steve Bryan, MP, writes, earlier in the month, the government confirmed it will invest £143 million in improving children's mental health services this year. This is terrific news, and something I, as a member of the team at the Department of Health since May, have been keen to push from the inside. The funding is part of a £1.25 billion, which will be allocated to children and adolescents' mental health services in England, with an additional £30 million to be spent helping people tackle eating disorders. The deal includes a guarantee that for the first time we have waiting time targets for mental health, just as we do every other illness. A new report called Future in Mind has been published by the Children and Young People's Mental Health and Wellbeing Task Force, which was established to consider ways to make it easier for children, young people, parents and carers to access help and support when needed. It looks how to improve the way that youth mental health services are organised, commissioned and provided. I would recommend it to anyone with an interest in this area. Key themes of the report include promoting resilience, prevention and early intervention, improving access to effective support, care for the most vulnerable, accountability and transparency, and developing the workforce in this field. This is a very important piece of work, and something I have championed since entering Parliament in 2010. Mental health has been the Cinderella service of the NHS for too long, and this new Conservative government is determined to end that. One of the key recommendations from Future in Mind is a joint collaboration between the Department for Education and NHS England, with clinical commissioning groups linking up with schools to operate a new pilot scheme involving CAMHS. This is very much needed and of great interest to me, as I am already in active discussions with local head teachers who are increasingly concerned at the presentation of anxiety-related problems among young people and the pressure that is putting on their core work, which is, at the end of the day, to provide children with an education. Returning to eating disorders, finally, and I recently received a special report written by Winchester-based Fixers at the Department of Health. It is as moving as it is impressive. And you can access it, as well as links to the other reports I mention above, via www.stevebryan.com/, in capital letters, Fixers. You can find more information about my continuing work as your local MP in Winchester and Westminster via www.stevebryan.com or on 01962 791110. That's 01962 791110. Steve Bryan, MP.
First person this week is written by Ron Allison, and the title of it is The BBC at a Crossroads. Every 10 years, the television licence, with which, by way of a royal charter, the BBC is funded, comes up for review, and the BBC hopes for renewal. The decisions for the decade from 2016 are currently being debated. When it was first introduced in 1922, the licence fee was for the wireless. After the end of the Second World War, it was extended to cover television, and later, in 1968, an extra charge was added for colour. By then, the BBC had lost its monopoly hold, but was still faced only with opposition from ITV. The latter's income came, of course, from advertising revenue. On the whole, most viewers and listeners were satisfied with this arrangement, though some grumbled about paying the licence fee as they never watched the BBC. If that was the case, then they missed very many good programmes. Equally, those who took a dislike to commercial breaks and therefore watched only the BBC denied themselves much entertainment on ITV. Now, of course, it's all so different. An amazing flow of technical developments have transformed the landscape entirely. The choice we viewers have is amazing. Sky in its many manifestations, more BBC and ITV channels, BT and digital outlets, almost too numerous to count. Add to them all the online services, the various personal devices, and it's all a bit overwhelming. But will they together overwhelm the BBC? I doubt if many of us would want that to happen. But at the same time, I doubt if many of us think that the corporation can just go on in the same old way. It has to stick to some basics, however. To inform, educate and entertain was the doctrine of the founding father, John Reith, and that need not change. Develop, yes, and in the nearest years to come, it should do so to the benefit of everyone who one way or another is a stakeholder in this particular national institution. The current Director General, Tony Hall, believes the BBC to be, quote, the greatest cultural force this country has both here and abroad, unquote. That's why he took the job. He knows the BBC cannot stand still. It must continue to adapt and reform. He points out that the process has begun with the switching of BBC Three to the internet and with the making of cuts in the corporation's overheads. The aim is to ensure as much money as possible goes on programme content. One of his predecessors, as DG, Michael Grade, has asked if it's too much to hope that the BBC could, just for once, volunteer a radical rationalisation of its size, scope and complexity. To do so, he says, would not be a denial of faith. It would disarm its enemies, transform political perceptions and enhance its independence for the foreseeable future. The enemies Grade mentions he describes as those who would like to see the BBC reduced simply to an elitist ghetto, defined as niche, uncommercial, unpopular programming. Others, of course, have equally strong views on funding. Some favour commercialisation. Others would prefer to fund the corporation through income tax. Another possibility would include elements of subscription and so on. What may concern many of us is whether we will still be able to depend on the BBC for, above all else, accurate, unbiased news reporting, as well as, at another level, accurate, unbiased judging on Strictly Come Dancing. So when this month the BBC publishes its own proposals for the future, stand by for a pretty fierce debate. The corporation had better be ready to defend its corner. Insofar as I can judge popular opinion, the BBC will find more supporters than opponents, but that does not mean the corporation can be complacent. Michael Grade was straightforward enough. I would die in a ditch for the BBC and its monopoly funding, he wrote in The Times. But it has to change. I could not put it better.
There are no special announcements this week, but let's see what's on for the rest of September. On Saturday, the 12th of September, at Nairmy House at Sutton Scotney. There is an open day and fete starting at 11 a.m. And more information on this can be found by telephoning 01962 760 060. That's 01962 760 060. Also on Saturday, the 12th of September, there is the Rumsey Show at Broadstairs Park. That commences at 8 a.m. and goes through until 6 p.m. Advance tickets are available from the Hampshire Chronicle, presumably their Rumsey office, which is 01794 517 521. That's 01794 517 521. And there are complimentary tickets for carers. From Saturday, again on Saturday the 19th of September through to Sunday the 27th of September, there is the Worthy Festival, a festival week of live music, entertainment and local food. It says here from 10 a.m. to 11 p.m. and a firework finale, which I presume will be on the last day. But more information about the Worthy Festival you can get by telephoning 01962 884981. That's 01962 884981. From Saturday the 19th of September through to Saturday the 26th of September, the Chesil Theatre is presenting One for the Road, and tickets and further information are available from 01962 867086. That's 01962 867086. And on the weekend of Saturday the 19th and Sunday the 20th, the Watercress Line at Alsford has an open weekend, so there's a chance to find out what goes on in the big sheds. And information and tickets are available by phoning 01962 733810. That's 01962 733810. And advance information that on the 24th of September at the Aegeus Bowl, formerly known, I believe, as the Rose Bowl, Open Sight is organising an eye contact exhibition, which presumably will show all kinds of aids and help for people with reduced eyesight. Anyway, we'll be giving more details about that in a future What's On feature. The lighting up times. Today, Friday the 4th of September, the sun rose at 6:25 in the morning, that's 25 past 6 in the morning, and will be setting at 7:45, that's 7:45 in the evening. Wednesday of next week, sunrise will be at 6:30 in the morning and sunset at 7:35 in the evening. If you know someone who is sight impaired and would like to receive our recordings, or if you have any problems with your memory stick or your player, the person to contact is Irene Dowding on 01962 870 370. There's a laminated card with this information inside each wallet should you need it, but please leave the card inside the wallet when you return it. We now move on to items of general news interest.
Log cabin home to hundreds of scouts. Nick Elborough recounts the history of a unique scout hut which will be formally reopened after a refurbishment next Thursday. Many people are unaware that there is Canadian-style log cabin hidden away on the Stopbridge Road in Winchester. But this unique building has been home to the 11th Winchester Scout Group since 1963, and it is soon to have a new lease of life as a freshly renovated community hub. The building has a fascinating history, which goes back to 1951, when the old National Fire Service hut on Week Hill, just above the Roebuck Inn, which served as HQ for the 11th Winchester Scouts after the war, began to crumble under the weight of its asbestos roof. An old allotment on the opposite side of the road was bought from Winchester College, and a plan for a sectional steel-framed hut with asbestos outside and wood inside was drawn up. Thankfully, this plan was sidelined in favour of building a log cabin-style building designed by Michael Garrett, a former scout. There were a few such cabins used by scouts for camping, but this was possibly the only one to be used as a scout HQ in the UK. Donations of 2 shillings and 6p were invited to buy disused telegraph poles from the GPO, and the foundation log, especially built weighing half a ton, was laid in 1953 by the mayor, Alderman Doris Edmeans. Most of the work was done by scouts, parents, leaders, and other volunteers themselves, along with raising funds, which amounted to £2,150 until finally, in October 1961, 8 years after it was begun, the cabin was officially opened with due pomp and ceremony by the County Commissioner, Air Vice Marshal C.N.H. Bilney, C.B., C.B.E. Ever since, it has been home to the 11th Winchester, as well as other clubs, and even for many years, providing a temporary classroom for Weston Primary School in the 1960s. It is still headquarters to the thriving 11th Winchester, which now comprises a beaver colony, 2 cub packs, 2 scout troops, and an explorer group. The current refurbishment and extension retains the charm of the original building, but it now has a modern kitchen and toilet block and disabled access, as well as more light and space. It is hoped that this will unlock the potential of the building so it can become an exciting hub for the local community. The Veolia Environmental Trust awarded £65,000, and the scouts themselves raised another £30,000. Further help was provided by Millgate Winchester, E. Francis Architects, and Elliott's Building Merchants. In the spirit of the building, much of the current work has been completed by scouts, leaders and parent volunteers, as it was in the 1950s. The official opening takes place on Thursday, September the 10th. The 11th Winchester would love to hear from any old scouts or leaders involved in the original building work who have memories of their time at the cabin. Many interesting documents and photos have been unearthed, and it would be great to add personal stories to those archives. Contact Scout Leader Giles Gooding on 01962 870496. That's the contact the Scout Leader Giles Gooding on 01962 870496. And this is accompanied by 2 photographs, one showing the official opening in 1961, where I presume the scoutmaster and various other dignitaries are standing up and proudly announcing things. And then there is a picture from 1957 entitled Golden Jubilee of Scouting Outside the Half-Completed Log Cabin off Stockbridge Road in Fulford. And there are row upon row upon row of scouts and cubs in their uniform, looking very pleased with the possible outcome of the log cabin.
Speeding blitz catches 2,000. Nearly 2,000 people were caught speeding across Hampshire and the Isle of Wight in a 1-week campaign to crack down on driving offences. The week of speed enforcement was part of Hampshire Police's and the European Traffic Police Network's speed enforcement campaign. The results from Hampshire and the Isle of Wight saw 1,938 vehicles exceeding the speed limit. Of those, 403 were detected by roads policing officers, and the remaining 1,535 were caught by mobile or static safety cameras. A breakdown of the results revealed 74% of the motorists caught speeding were men, whilst 80% of offences occurred on roads with a speed limit of 30 miles per hour. Most of the offenders were car drivers, 80%, whilst 17% were van drivers, and nearly half of the people caught speeding were offered a speed awareness course, and 47% were given a fixed penalty notice, and only 1% were reported for summons. Hampshire Constabulary's Roads Policing Unit Sergeant Rob Hurd said, "Excessive or inappropriate speed has an appalling impact when you're involved in a collision. The forces experienced by the human body in a collision increase exponentially as the speed increases. If you collide with a pedestrian at 30 miles an hour, they have an 80% chance of survival. However, if you collide at 40 miles an hour, then the pedestrian has only a 20% chance of survival. Our focus on those who endanger lives on our roads is relentless through both enforcement and education. Nearly half of all those caught will be offered a national speed awareness course as an alternative to prosecution. This approach is aimed at improving knowledge and attitudes to influence better behaviour on the roads. These results in the space of just 1 week, it was August the 17th to the 23rd, show too many people are putting lives in danger on our roads. Just under 90% of people caught speeding were in 30 or 40 mile an hour limits. These speed limits are in locations where there are often greater hazards and numbers of road users."
A Hampshire bus operator is investing millions in a new fleet of buses as it expands its service on key routes, including to Winchester. Blue Star has ordered 20 new vehicles at a cost of £3.2 million. This comes as it rolls out changes to a number of bus services, including an increased service on a flagship route. The single and double-decker buses are due to be delivered at the end of October or early November. The company said the move was in response to what bus users had told them they wanted to see. Andrew Wickham, managing director of Blue Star, said that this was the firm's biggest ever single investment in vehicles. These brand new British-built buses will provide comfort, reliability and more seats for those travelling, he said. Blue Star has also announced revisions to its timetable after taking on board customer feedback. A key change to its Blue Star One service between Southampton, Chandler's Ford and Winchester. This will now run every 15 minutes instead of every 20 minutes outside peak times and more frequently than at present at peak times. There will be extra buses to ease the busy afternoon journeys from Winchester to help customers and students from Peter Simmons College. "We are introducing new vehicles and increasing the frequency because we know how important this route is for students at Peter Simmons College and others commuting between Southampton and Winchester," said Mr. Wickham. "We are also sending the peak journeys to Winchester Railway Station." Blue Star says it has also made changes or added services to improve high frequency routes, the Blue Star 18, the Blue Star 5 to Rumsey and Waterside routes, to make them more reliable and on time.
A fleet of minis for council. Winchester workers have been scratching their heads over the sudden appearance of a fleet of minis near the city's railway station. But there will be no Italian job heist. The cars are pool vehicles for council workers. Not a lot of people know that. The pristine five-door models, sited in silver, green and sky blue, are shared by Hampshire County Council, according to social media. The council failed to respond to a formal query from the Chronicle. But in 2013, when the scheme was unveiled, Transport Manager Paul Leaves told Fleet News The Mini is funky and should appeal to young professionals who might want to use them. And there is a colour photograph showing about six or seven of the Minis in their various colours parked against what looks like the record office walls under the tree-lined gravel approach to the station, all ready for takeoff.
Project shortlisted. A project to rebuild a pavilion in South Wanston has been shortlisted for a cash grant. The new pavilion project could get a grant of £12,500 by M&S Energy should it receive enough votes. It is hoped that the pavilion rebuild at the recreation ground will help sports clubs in the area. The money from the grant would go towards paying for a heat pump.
Inquiry into hit-and-run killing. The son of a Winchester woman killed by a hit-and-run driver after his early release from prison has spoken of his desire for answers ahead of an inquiry into the case. Grandmother Gwen Valentine, 62, of Wavell Way, Stanmore, was mowed down on the Isle of Wight last year, just weeks before her wedding. Island officials have launched an inquiry into how Donovan Kitching, who admitted death by dangerous driving after escaping a police breath test, was allowed out on parole 3 weeks before the incident. Gwen's son, Neil, told the Chronicle that questions needed to be asked of the island's probation system. The 33-year-old, also of Wavell Way, said, "Our primary concern is about the system as it stands in the Isle of Man and whether the checks that were in place were robust enough. Our feeling is that we want that to be looked at."
New care homes. Two new specialist care homes have been developed in villages near Winchester. Compton House and Otterbourne House, both of the Choice Care Group, have been built to provide 24-hour support for people with learning difficulties, autism, and complex care needs. Compton House has been created by refurbishing an existing property, and it boasts as much as 8 ensuite bedrooms, along with 3 separate self-contained annexes. Otterbourne House is a brand new, purpose-built service, contemporary residential home, specially designed to meet the needs of individual residents. It has 7 ensuite rooms and 2 separate self-contained annexes. These 2 new homes will be added to the care group's existing 56 others spread across the southeast, including Wiltshire, Berkshire, and Oxfordshire.
Shop reopenings hit by delays. A host of empty shops in Winchester High Street are facing delays in reopening. Legal wrangles, failed takeovers, and the unique demand of historic buildings are among the reasons why 2 of the city's most prominent shops remain unused. The former HMV store was due to be split into a Carphone warehouse and Clinton's card shop, but has yet to be refurbished. A former JJB sports unit by the Buttercross is due to reopen as a clothes shop in October, after more than 2 years, while deals are yet to be struck for sites previously occupied by Santander and Phones for You. Chris Turner, Executive Director of Winchester Business Improvement District, BID, said, "It's the specialist companies that refurbish these shops to a very high standard. They're few and far between. It just takes longer than we expected." The JJB unit has been closed since 2013, despite being leased last year to clothing firm White Stuff, which will relocate from Market Lane. Refurbishment has now begun, and the shop is expected to open in October. JJB collapsed in 2012, but the Winchester branch continued as a cheap outlet for several months after Sports Direct bought its stock. It was subject to 2 failed takeovers by restaurant chains before White Stuff stepped in. Since then, the shop front has become a street tribute to campaigner Hayden Burton. Or might be Hayden Burton, I'm not sure. The Chronicle understands that a handful of retailers are interested in the Santander site next door to the old HMV and Phones for You branch, which closed in September. But Winchester BID has not been asked to remove its branding from either shop front, suggesting deals are not imminent. Joe Harvey, managing partner of Charters Commercial, which is handling the JJB unit, said, "Demand for retail premises in Winchester High Street still remains extremely high. However, in respect of this property, there have been several delays in re-letting the premises, which have been primarily due to its age and condition. This has included asbestos removal, roof repairs and other works requiring planning permission. In addition to this, the legalities of an aborted lease agreement also pushed back its completion. We are very confident now that we are on the home stretch." He added, "Individual shop fronts and their buildings need to be considered on an individual basis, as many carry numerous quirks and issues that fall under the guise of listed building, raising issues for necessary consents and planning. Winchester's historic nature creates obstacles for retailers wanting to favour our city versus the modern shopping malls of West Quay, Gun Wharf and Festival Place."
Duchess accepts role. A world-famous Hampshire garden has royal approval. The Duchess of Cornwall is the new president of the Sir Harold Hillier Gardens at Amfield near Romsey. The Duchess visited the 180-acre site in 2013 to officially open the centenary border, laid out to mark the 60th anniversary of the gardens created by the globe-trotting plantsman Sir Harold Hillier in 1953. Sir Harold, who died in January 1985, handed over his beloved collection of more than 42,000 plants at the Hillier Arboretum to Hampshire County Council in 1977. He collected many plants and seeds during the 1950s from around the world, including North and South America, Japan and Australasia, then brought them back to Hampshire, where he got them to grow into specimen trees and shrubs. And the public can now see the English plantsman legacy at the Sir Harold Hillier Gardens, which attracts about 170,000 visitors annually. The gardens are a riot of colour year-round, with specimen magnolia trees, azaleas and camellias in bloom in the spring, along with daffodils, and throughout the summer, various eye-catching hydrangeas and herbaceous borders that are in full colour. In the autumn and winter months, visitors flock to see the gardens, to see leaves on the trees and shrubs change colour, and also winter flowering shrubs and bulbs. Sir Harold's son, Robert Hillier, who is now head of his late father's award-winning Hillier's Nurseries business, said, "I'm absolutely delighted that Her Royal Highness the Duchess of Cornwall has agreed to accept the position of President of the Sir Harold Hillier Gardens. This is a great royal tribute to my father's achievements and to a place that has become very special to a great many people." The gardens contain more than a dozen national plant collections, which includes 12,000 different species and cultivars and more than 400 champion trees, the largest of their species in the British Isles. Hampshire County Council leader Roy Perry also welcomed the news that the Duchess has agreed to become the Sir Harold Hillier Gardens president and will work alongside its patrons Lord Sainsbury and Roy Lancaster, who is a former curator at the Germans Lane site. Councillor Perry said, "We are very honoured and delighted to have the Duchess of Cornwall as president of the Sir Harold Hillier Gardens, which is a garden of enormous historic and scientific importance and a very popular attraction for families across Hampshire and beyond." He added, "The Sir Harold Hillier's gardens are world famous, holding one of the largest collections of hardy trees and shrubs in the world, and are also renowned for a significant collection of rare plants. We are very fortunate in Hampshire to have a great many beautiful gardens and outdoor attractions.
Project will drive home safety lesson. It is the van that will hit the streets of Winchester. I'm not quite sure that that's the right verb to use. And further afield to deliver road safety messages. The specially designed van carries pictogram images in the shape of road signs representing reasons people are killed and injured in accidents on the road. It was handed over to Hampshire Constabulary by Martins Peugeot in Eastern Lane, Winchester. The pictogram design on the van was created by police and partner agencies, and the concept was called Project Pictogram. The pictogram displays messages of the fatal four reasons people are killed and injured in car accidents. These are inappropriate speed, driver distractions, not wearing a seat belt, and alcohol or drug impairment. Police hope that the van, which will be driven around the county, will help to nudge road users into driving carefully and safely. Hampshire Constabulary Road Safety Officer Sergeant Rob Hurd said, "I have been at far too many collisions when these four have been a factor. Many people have lost their lives unnecessarily, causing heartache and destroying families. Our key message is that it's not worth the risk." The design of the van is powerful, and when people see this vehicle, I want it to remind them of the risks we all face on the roads when those who speed, use their mobile phone whilst driving, fail to wear a seatbelt, or drive under the influence. I'm grateful to Martins Peugeot, whose staff understand the importance of promoting road safety, and in doing so, have supplied the van to help raise awareness. And this article is accompanied by a photograph of the van. It's in bright blue with the road signs picturing the four reasons, the fatal four reasons, that people are killed. And, of course, the proud driver alongside it, presumably. I don't know whether it is Sergeant Rob Hurd, but still, it's well worth the efforts of the Peugeot garage.
Postie's wish of pop hit. A postman who works in Twyford near Winchester is hoping his next delivery will be a number one hit single. By day, Darren Haynes works for the Royal Mail. But in his spare time, he's a songwriter, and he's hoping his lyrical talents will see him crowned the UK songwriting champion. The 48-year-old, who lives in Bitton in Southampton, has made it through to the semi-finals of the competition with Move Your Body. The song has a special Hampshire connection, as it is sung by Charlie McCauley from Millbrook, and was produced in Mutant Lab Studios in Bargate Street. It is not the first time that Darren's creative talents have impressed. In 2013, he won through to the semi-finals of the International Songwriting Competition with another song he penned called You'll Be Sorry. Darren said, "The more I do it, the more creative I get. The thing that makes Move Your Body special is that it's the song features a local singer, local producer and local songwriter. I was delighted when I found out I made it through. It feels like all the hard work has paid off. It's great hearing the final product, from when you get a tune in your head in the beginning to it being produced. It sounds so much better when it's been mixed and mastered by professionals." Inspiration hits Darren at the strangest moments. He was watching X Factor and saw Cheryl Fernandez-Vicini praise a contestant using the phrase liquid gold, and he quickly wrote a song called Just That. He finds out if Move Your Body has reached the final in November.
Winchester could be stripped of overnight fire cover from full-time staff under sweeping changes proposed by Hampshire Fire and Rescue Service. Response times would be increased by nearly 5 minutes under one or of two options to be voted on next week, confirming fears that senior firefighters revealed by this newspaper in June. Retained stations in villages, including Alresford, Sutton, Scotney and Bishop's Waltham, will see reduced vehicle fleets and staff cuts of up to a third. Fire chiefs have stressed that no stations will close as they cut staffing across the county by nearly 18% to save £12.2 million. Deputy Chief Officer Neil Odin promised no compulsory redundancies. Option one for Winchester would see the city stripped of full-time firefighters overnight, with on-call staff who respond from home increased from 12 to 14 both day and night. Full-time staff would be cut by half to 14 during the day, with the average first response time expected to increase by 4.5 minutes. Option two would see the same daytime cuts to full-time staff, with two immediate firefighters overnight. Meanwhile, the number of on-call firefighters would reduce from 12 to 10 both day and night. The average response time would increase by 20 seconds.
Bright Idea slashes street light cost. An innovative project in Hampshire, the largest of its kind, has meant huge savings for the public purse. Since 2010, the County Council's consumption of electricity for street lighting has been slashed by 41%, equivalent to powering 3,500 homes per year. The complete lighting control central management system, supplied by Mayflower, allows individual lights, signs and bollards to be better monitored and controlled. Hampshire's Executive Member for Economy, Transport and Environment, Sean Woodward, said, "The installation of the latest technology will give us greater flexibility in how we manage street lights, giving improved visibility in areas that need it and the ability to dim lighting in other areas that don't."
Macaque's arrival is mini marvel for zoo. A new little primate has been getting children excited during the summer holidays as it tries to find its feet. A baby Sulawesi crested macaque was born on July the 28th to mum Drusilla and dad Douglas, the first to be born at Marwell Zoo for 10 years. They are critically endangered in the wild. They live in tropical rainforests and mangrove swamp areas in the north of the Indonesian island. But they face many threats in the wild, one of which is being overhunted for food, as they're considered to be a delicacy in areas of Sulawesi. Claire Mound, team leader for primates and small mammals at the zoo near Colden Common, said, "We expect the baby will spend the first 4 months close to Drusilla whilst it gains strength, develops and finds its feet." Ms. Mound added, "Other members of the group may eventually also take a part in the rearing, but at the moment, Drusilla wants to keep a tight hold on her new arrival." When first born, the infants have a pink face, hands and legs, which will darken over time, eventually becoming black. They are noted for their punk rocker-style crest of hair, which forms as the baby matures. The baby is the latest addition to the European Endangered Species Breeding Programme, whereby European zoos coordinate their programmes to ensure they maximise the chances of successful breeding. And this piece is accompanied by, not surprisingly, a photograph of this little chap who looks absolutely adorable.
So, trip to Marwell Zoo is perhaps called for. That concludes our extracts from the week. Our thanks to our editors, who were Jean Carswell, Ken Clemenson and Barbara Chase, and to our various technical teams. And thanks to our readers, Margot Meredith.
Goodbye.
And John Richards.
Goodbye.
And from me, John Parker, goodbye too. Please return the memory stick as soon as you're able, not forgetting to put your address label inside the envelope.